Welcome to The Gathering Resources.
The following audio is from Main Stage Session 3 at our 2021 conference. This session features Mile Green and David French.
So in the second century, there was a writer named Dionysius, and he observed Christians in action. He himself was not a believer, not a follower of Jesus, but he observed them and saw how odd condition of citizenship, which they exhibit, is wonderful and admittedly strange. They live in countries of their own, but simply as sojourners. They share the life of citizens. They endure the lot of foreigners. Every foreign land is to them a homeland, and every homeland a foreign land. They spend their existence upon the earth, but their citizenship is in heaven. It's fascinating that you can see one person observing Christians, and you can hear in Anna's story, and you'll hear in Miles' story, Mile Green, another person who's lived as a foreigner in a foreign land, but took it as his homeland, and then returns here back to the United States to help foreigners make their home here. So, Mile, please come up.
Thank you, Josh, for the introduction. So I work with an agency called World Relief, and it's an organization that I love. It's an organization I've worked with for 14 years. A third of my life has been spent with that organization, and much of that time I lived in Africa working with them for 9 years in Rwanda. And I have many memorable moments and many memorable days, but August 15th, 2021 will always be one of the days that I remember very, very distinctly and very well. It was the day that I became President and CEO of World Relief, which is a huge accomplishment, but it's also the day that Kabul fell. And, you know, we all watched on the news. You watched what happened, I watched what happened, and we were in shock at the chaos that was unfolding in that country. And, you know, 20 years ago, most of us in the room didn't know who the Taliban were, but we quickly learned about that, and we knew for the last 20 years who the Taliban were. So we knew when they were taking over Kabul that this meant the future of women and girls and religious minorities and others were deeply changed for the future, and there was great heartache to come. But this is also something that hits very close to home for World Relief, because we're an agency, one of the eight agencies in the United States who have been contracted by the U.S. government to resettle refugees. And when they come to this country, to welcome them home and to make them part of this society, and that's the mandate that we've been given to do. And so it hit very close to home for us. We have been resettling refugees for 40 years, and we've resettled over 300,000 refugees with the partnership of local churches and connection. And in the last decade, 8,000 of those people resettled have been Afghans who have come to this country. And since the 1st of August, we've welcomed more than 800 Afghans to this country, and we're preparing for more. And so as this crisis is unfolded, it hits very close to home, because the Afghan community are our friends. They're those that we spend time with. And so, you know, in the events of August 15th happened, our phones were ringing off the hook. And we had people coming into our offices saying, you know, you've helped us, you're our friend, what can we do together? And we found ourselves praying with them, weeping with them, not knowing if their friends and family would be evacuated. And we also had many of our staff around the country who were dispatched in the days following August 15th to these U.S. military installations. And they were doing the paperwork for this huge number of people who have come into the country. And one of my colleagues that I've worked with for many years, she sent me a note on text message, and just heartbroken. And she said, I met a man today who boarded in the chaos of the military evacuations, was put on a different plane from his 11-year-old daughter, 11-year-old twin daughters. He landed in Wisconsin at a military base and didn't know where his daughters landed. And worst of all, when he reached into his pocket, he realized that he had the passports of those two girls, their only form of identification. And so people have experienced the worst days of their life, days worse than anything I've known, and I just wept. I found myself weeping after 2 weeks of working on evacuation, mobilizing people, saying, God, what is going on? And I think as you've seen these images, you probably share many of the same feelings of what's happening here. And you know, I'll show you a data point here. And this is the history of the number of refugees resettled in this country by the US government since the formal refugee resettlement program began in 1980. And so what you see is, at, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was many people coming from Vietnam, some from Cuba, and then decline over time, and then the wars in the Balkans, and then 9/11, there was a drop. And then we reached a normal plateau for many years. And then the last 4 years, we knew that there was reasons why the government stopped welcoming refugees. And we reached an all-time low over the last 4 years of refugees welcomed to this country. But what we're seeing here is already 120,000 people have been evacuated. There's many people flooding into bordering countries. And yesterday, the president requested funding for Congress to facilitate the evacuation of at least 100,000 people in the next year, a year and a half. And so we're expecting to resettle at our agency and all of the other nine peer agencies more refugees in the next 3 months than we've resettled in the last 3 years alone. So this is a historic moment for our country. It's a historic moment for organizations like mine and for all of you and for the Christians in this country. And it's something that we say, is this just a challenge to deal with another challenge, or is this a great opportunity for the future? But you know, maybe you're walking through this crisis and say, this is the first time the issue of refugees has ever affected my heart. And you're wondering, can I go outside of my comfort zone and serve someone who comes from a different religious background than me, or to serve someone who comes from a different country and nationality, speaks a different language as you? So let me tell you a story. And it's a story that takes place in Chicago. And it's a story of a young man who had been a translator for the US military and his wife. And they were brought to this country and resettled by World Relief in Chicago. And World Relief does what we always did. We met them at the airport. We set them up in their first apartment. We helped them find jobs. We got the woman in English language school because she was not a translator. And it's good work. It's the work we do every day, but that's not the story. The story is that at the same time, there was a group of young adult couples at Wheaton Bible Church. And they were being trained and mobilized by their church to know how to reach out to new visitors and new people in this country and what it looks like to really give them a community of welcome. We call these groups good neighbor teams. And so this good neighbor team of all young couples joined around, and they got to know this couple. They learned how to ride the suburban bus routes in the Wheaton area. They helped them eventually negotiate the car prices at a used car dealership to help this couple buy. They went through the grocery store showing them how to pick out the right foods and to do it well, and just spent time with people. They even began to show them how to do things for fun in this country, the swimming pool, the movie theaters. And so over time, they went from being friends, or from being someone here to help, to being friends. And then Ramadan came, and this couple said, we would love to come and break our fast one day in your house. Can we come and do that? And the people said, okay, yeah, sure. And they waited for the sun to set, and as the sun was setting, they prayed over the meal that they were about to consume together. And the woman, and each prayed in their own religion and their own tradition, and the woman asked the question, why don't Christians fast? And the couple said, oh, well, we do fast. And they reached into the scriptures, and they pulled out the Bible, and they read the story of Jesus fasting in his temptation. And the woman said, Isa, Jesus, who would have known? He fasted. And then later, when they were observing all that was happening in society around them, the culture, this Christmas holiday, they said, what is this thing? Can you tell us about it? And they said, come to our church, and you'll find out. And they went to Christmas Eve service, and the pastor preached on the story of the woman who bled for 12 years and Jesus healed. And this woman who herself was unable to carry children, to bear children, she said, not only did Isa fast, he cared about women. And so for us, we are in a very, you know, historic moment to welcome tens of thousands of people and put communities of welcome around them. And when a refugee comes to this country, they need some very practical things. They need housing. They need to learn the language. They need to find jobs. I know some of you here can create jobs and make opportunities for people. They need transportation, financial assistance. They need to get their kids registered and enrolled in school, legal services to move through all those different steps in our immigration process. But we find at the end of the day, what's most important and what's most critical is community connections, because transformation cannot happen without relationship. And so when these individuals, they fled Kabul, they fled the face of evil. And for me, it's been heartbreaking thinking about the fact that these people, most of them who left their houses with just the things they could carry in their pocket, locked their doors, many of them show up carrying still the keys to the front door of their house, and they fled away from evil. And the verses that have brought comfort to me, and I've reflected on a lot, is in Romans 12, 21. It says, "Do not be overcome by evil, but repay evil with good." And so in this moment, you know, we've got a chance to repay evil with good. The scriptures also say we're created in Christ Jesus to do good works that he has prepared in advance for us to do. And good works take on many different forms. It can be walking through the grocery store with someone, showing them where to buy things and where to get things. It can be offering a job to someone. It can be renting your apartment to them. And it's the everyday things that are our chance to show good works. And it's for people who are fleeing true evil that we can do good in this moment. And so in closing, I want to give you a thought. It says in Acts chapter 17 that God has determined the exact time and places that people live on this earth for his purposes. And research has shown us that the people in Afghanistan are one of the few countries in the world where less than 5% of the population even knows a Christian. So I want to ask you a question. Could it be that God's ordained purposes are bringing them here to meet you, to meet me, to see good works done as they flee a place of evil? So the church has a unique opportunity before us today. And let us love our neighbors in the way that Christ loved us. And let us use the resources that God has given us, the time that God has given us, and the skills that God has given us to love people and make this a place of good for them and a new home of welcome. So thank you, and God bless you.
Our next speaker is David French. The very best journalists afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I think David's done a great job of doing both of those things. We heard earlier this morning from Rachel Den Hollander talking about how we can listen and use our power on behalf of the powerless. And David does that enormously and enormously well with the power of the pen. And he also holds people accountable, people in power who are to be held accountable. It's such that he writes informed arguments, or that they're informed by a deep Christian faith. It's also shaped by a life in action. So he's been litigating in courts on behalf of our rights in the First Amendment, on behalf of Christian schools and ministries. He's flown into Baghdad during the most turbulent, dangerous times of the Iraq War as a JAG officer. And these ideas, these experiences have shaped his writing. So I'm so pleased for you all to have a chance to hear from David French. Thanks, David.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm just going to dive right in because what I'm going to talk about is hatred and animosity and the cruelty of our age. So aren't you excited? So that's great. So I come from, I was a son of the South. I was born in Opelika, Alabama. My parents were Auburn students, War Eagles, so I don't want to already divide the room, but I just did. And so I grew up in Alabama, grew up in Kentucky, grew up in Tennessee, went to a small college, Christian college in Tennessee called Lipscomb University. Some of you might know it. And, you know, kind of, you know, grew up in a pretty insular evangelical slash fundamentalist world. And then in 1991, something happened that changed my life. I got into Harvard Law School. Now, I still don't know how that happened. I think there might have been some sort of secret redneck diversity quotient. But nonetheless, I got in. And so I go there, and I am fired up. I'm ready. I can't wait. Well, I'm actually terrified, scared, don't believe that I belong. But also part of me was fired up and ready. And you know what I was ready to do? I was ready to engage in discussion and debate and discourse. And I couldn't wait to sort of test my ideas and my thoughts against some of the smartest law students in America. I just couldn't wait. And I arrived there in 1991, and it was at the height of the first real wave of political correctness in the U.S. This is where there'd be shout downs and boos and hisses in class, and if you advance something that people didn't like in the room. I remember starting with, there's about 1,500 law students there, and with two other friends, so there was three of us, we started the first pro-life group at the law school called the Society for Law, Life, and Religion. So if you're ever thinking of forming a group, always think of the acronym. So for the next 20 years at Harvard Law School, we were SLUR. So I founded SLUR in 1991. And one of the first things that we did was we put together a letter to the student body, because Harvard had a policy that said that your health services fee pays for elective abortions. But there's a, if you have a conscientious objection to abortion, you can write a short letter and get a refund of that portion or fee. It was a good policy that the school had that protected and respected rights of conscience. So we thought, hey, let's introduce ourselves to the student body by writing a letter, making them aware of this policy. And so we sort of like cast lots to see who would write the letter, and it fell on me. So I wrote it. It was very polite. It was very nice. I promise. It was very nice. I made it nicer with three different revisions. And I sent it out to everybody. Like literally, I ran off 1,500 copies and I put them into everybody's mailboxes. This is when only rich people had email and it was on AOL. And so I put it into everybody's box and I go to class the next day, come back to my box, and it is jammed with paper, just jammed. And I think, this is before I was predestined to become a Calvinist and realize the total depravity of man. And I thought for just a moment, I have tapped into the latent pro-life movement at Harvard Law School. This is fantastic. And I pull out the first piece of paper, and it says, "Why don't you go die?" The next one, "You're a bleeping fascist." Next one, "Why don't you go die, you fascist?" It was like they put out talking points to this guy, respond by either talking about his death, calling him a fascist, using profanity, or any combination of one through three. And I'm never going to say I received death threats. They were more like death aspirations. I'm not going to kill you. I just hope that something does, okay? So this was my introduction to really modern political battle. You know, when I was a young pro-life, evangelical, conservative, true, I guess now you call it, you wouldn't say true blue GOP. I guess you'd say a true red GOP. And it confirmed all my priors, right, about those people on the left, okay? That, and there are some people who are sitting here in this room who are people of the left are going, no, we're not like that. We're not all like that. And there's some people in this room kind of on the right going, they were like that. And, but that was my introduction to sort of the incredibly toxic way in which our political discourse has developed. But that was an early version. That was like the beta test. And so now we're in a position right now where the dominant expression of American political point of view is the dominant form of expression is animosity. And the dominant motivating idea behind American politics is animosity as well. It's hatred. It's dislike. And what I wrote a book. It's on your table. My dad has this saying that he says, "I'm going to give you two gifts when I give you a book. One is I'm going to give you the book, and number two is I'm never going to ask you if you read it," which is the second one's more valuable than the first one sometimes. And so I wrote a book, and I was noticing this remarkable rise of hatred in the United States of America, an incredible rise of hatred. And what I posited in there is that a nation, we're becoming more different culturally, we're becoming more different religiously, we're becoming every material, cultural, political, religious, and social force in the United States is driving us apart more than it's pushing us together. And that's not happening in a benign way. You know, it's not like we're saying, oh, you know, if I live in Tennessee, you Californians, you crazy, you know, you guys are nuts, but I love you anyway. It's you Californians. Don't you bring your ideas to, you know, and we have this incredible rising animosity. And this isn't just something that's subjective, right? This is objective. Let's go back to some numbers. In 2016, the Pew Foundation was doing a research on what's called negative partisanship. They began to notice that the animating force in American politics was negative partisanship. It is, I belong to the GOP because I hate or fear Democrats, not because I love GOP ideas. Or I belong to the Democratic Party because I hate or fear Republicans and not because I love Democratic ideas. And what they found was, in 2016, this is before Trump, 91% of Republicans had either very unfavorable or unfavorable views of Democrats. 91%. The percentage of Republicans that had grown to have unfavorable views, very unfavorable views of Democrats, had tripled since 1994, to where 56 Republicans, if all they knew about you, 56% of Republicans, if all they knew about you is that you're a Democrat, they're going to start with a very unfavorable view of you. 91%. So the Democrats, much more tolerant, only 86%. of Democrats had an extremely unfavorable view or unfavorable view of Republicans, with almost identical numbers having that very unfavorable view. So we're beginning to reach a crisis of animosity. And along with this crisis of animosity is coming with a crisis of cruelty in American politics. It's a crisis of cruelty. We have begun to see this emerge in very tangible ways. But first, let's give you a little bit more data. So I talked about my situation in law school where people had death aspirations for me. Turns out that death aspirations are rising. About 20% of Americans now believe that if a substantial portion of their political opponents just died, they just died, America would be better off. Now, you might be having a glass half full kind of moment and think, oh, only 80% of us don't want anyone to die. But 20% is about 60 plus million people are so deeply involved in politics and so deeply captured by hatred that they don't care if large percentages of their political opponents die. Equivalent numbers of people also hold the view that their political opponents have inhuman characteristics, subhuman characteristics. And then we see this show up very tangibly. I will tell you this. If you are a person of any prominence in American public life, whether you are on the right or on the left, you are going to face death threats. You're going to face them. And sometimes you're going to face them from your former friends. I'll never forget in late 2015, early 2016, I began to call out some things that I began to see about rising problems of race on the right. And I'll never forget the night that I wrote a post for National Review and I posted it online, calling out some language that I saw in one of the political debates and some online that was echoing of white nationalist movements that I'd seen emerging. It was within 30 minutes that pictures of my youngest daughter, African American, adopted from Ethiopia, was photoshopped in a gas chamber and put online. Within the hour, her face was photoshopped in slave fields and put online. And then the death threats started to come. And I'm not the only person who's had those experiences. This is the dominant experience that you have in the United States of America if you have a public voice and you dissent, often within your own group. Within your own group, you see a different side of it all. And that's where we are. One of the saddest things about the conflict between Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh was that both of them were under police protection the whole time because both of them were receiving nonstop threats. That's where we are. Now, this is where the story could get good, but doesn't. Because here's where it could get good. Because there's this giant population of people by the tens of millions in the United States of America who have this ethos. Bless those who persecute you. Love your enemies. What are the fruits of the Spirit? Kindness, patience, peace, joy, gentleness, self-control. Tens of millions of us. And boy, have we made that presence felt, haven't we? No. No. For millions upon millions upon millions of Christians, the pressure is this. If you have a coalition of the cruel against the coalition of the cruel, well then choose. Choose which coalition of the cruel will you join. You got to choose. You got to choose. But you don't. You don't. In fact, we know what we have to choose. We have to choose love your enemies. We have to choose bless those who persecute you. By the millions, by the tens of millions. You know, one of the things that I would say is the spirit of this age is cruelty. The spirit of this age is cruelty. And my goodness, is that an ideal opportunity for the cross to confront cruelty? What an absolute ideal opportunity for that. But there's something that we have to give up. There's something we have to give up before we can abandon the coalition of the cruel. Either coalition of the cruel you want to talk about. And that is we have to give up fear. We have to give up fear. I began to notice something. I served in Iraq during 2007, 2008 in Diyala province during the surge. And it was horrible, Diyala, at that time. It was the epicenter of the Sunni-Shia civil war. And in the Sunni-Shia civil war, one thing that I learned very quickly was that that civil war was not based on theological differences, although there were theological differences between Sunni and Shia. It was not even based on political differences all that much, even though there were differences over allocation of oil revenues and differences about who would command which army units and how would you, you know, who was going to have what share of the parliament. Those things were important and they were out there. What was it based on? Based on grievance and rage. Why are you fighting the Shia? Because they killed my cousin. Why are you fighting the Sunni? Because they killed my uncle. And something I noticed when I arrived back home, remember I was this sort of true blue or true red GOP partisan guy, something changed in my heart. Something changed in my heart when I saw that. And that there was mutual fear and mutual loathing, and that was motivating. That was motivating an enormous amount of atrocities. And I land in a country where thankfully the grievances weren't as severe. People weren't killing each other over politics yet, but they were certainly hating each other and they were certainly committing injustices against each other on the basis of politics. And each side had a list of grievances and the grievances were real. They weren't made up. People had done bad things to each other. And that was beginning to motivate and animate a spiral of anger, just this spiral of anger to the point where I began to feel like I was zigging in one way and everything else was, I was zigging away from partisanship where everything else was zagging towards it. And I look back and I remember I gave a speech at a conservative convention before I left. And I got to confess this because I was just awful. And I gave a speech and it was, you know, in conservative group, pro-life, religious liberty, conservative ideas, yay. And I was about to deploy. And this guy comes up to me and he says, why, or in the Q&A, why are you leaving America when you've got such a good fight to fight here? And I said, I puffed up my chest, because I believe the two great threats to the United States of America are jihadists abroad and radical leftists at home, and I feel called to fight them both. Yay! And then I went abroad and I saw radical jihadists. And it was horrible, and I realized, wait a minute, I had a good life in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My son was born in Ithaca, New York. The first year of my marriage was in Manhattan. I used to be a president of a nonprofit in Center City, Philadelphia. All those places are 90% blue, and nobody was trying to decapitate me. And I felt shame. I felt shame. I was abroad, and I was, by wearing the uniform, you're saying you're willing to die for somebody, not wanting to die, you're willing to die for them, and then you're going to come home and turn them into enemies? The very same people you're willing to die for? And it broke something in me in a good way. In a good way. So what is it we are supposed to do now? Look, if the spirit of the age is cruelty, We've got the answer to cruelty. We've got the answer to cruelty. There's something that's kind of come over us right now, and I'll call it a negative utopianism. So there's a kind of this utopianism that says, hey, I've got the greatest ideas in the world, and I will, you know, that's the old saying, I will, to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs, and I'll run people over to create something great, great and beautiful and awesome. But negative utopianism says, I'll just crush my enemies, and everything's going to be better once I crush my enemies. And that's where our politics are right now. I'm going to crush you. I'm going to end you, and then America will be better. But we have such a different model now. We have such a different model. And I'm going to go to two verses from the book of Micah. Here's one model. This is Micah 4:4. And, you know, if you're biblical scholars, you can probably quote right off the top of your head. If you're aficionados of pop culture, then you go, oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda. Because in the musical Hamilton, he quoted George Washington quoting Micah 4:4. And what's really interesting is if you look at George Washington's papers, here's a founding father. We know he had profound flaws, but he also had some profound virtues. And one of those, and 50 times in his writings, 50 times he used Micah 4:4 to describe his vision of the United States of America. Most famously, when he wrote the Hebrew congregation of Rhode Island, and he said to this very persecuted religious minority, you're going to have a home in this land. And what did he quote? Every man shall sit under his own vine and his own fig tree, and no one shall make him afraid. Every man shall sit under his own vine and his own fig tree, and no one shall make him afraid. To think about the promise of these Afghan refugees coming here, what a promise to make to them. You will have your own vine and fig tree, and no one will make you afraid. What a marvelous vision of American pluralism that says, I do not destroy my enemies. I do not destroy my enemies. I create a community and a civilization that helps them flourish as human beings. How do you do it? How do you do it? Let's go back to Micah. Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you, O man? What is good? It is to act justly. Okay, we got that down, don't we? We can tweet justice at each other with extreme venom. We can mobilize to enact policies that we believe are just with extreme prejudice. But that the verse doesn't end there. To act justly, to love kindness. Other translations say love mercy. Act justly, love mercy. And then there's the third component, to walk humbly before the Lord your God. When I think of American Christian culture, wherever you stand on the political spectrum, because I'm not going to urge you to go one way or another way, what I am going to urge you to do is to offer an alternative way of being in that culture. And that alternative way of being is look at another fellow human being, maybe somebody who disagrees with you vehemently and just trolled you on Twitter. And I urge you not all to be on that infernal website, and I'm a hypocrite because I'm on it. But somebody, a new way of being, even to your most bitter political opponent, to somebody that is advancing an idea that you really dislike, that you despise, and you say, you know what? You, created in the image of God, deserve to have your own vine and fig tree and live under it where no one will make you afraid. And how am I going to do that? I don't know, but as I progress towards that, I'm going to try to act justly. I'm going to try to love mercy as an imperfect human being, and I'm going to try to walk humbly before my God. And I can tell you, if we have an age of cruelty, veering towards the age of compassion that is told to us in our scriptures, that this is to define who we are, that is an answer. I'll end with this. I was at this one of these conferences with Christian leaders, and we're having one of these powwows of all these people in their big constituencies, and they're like, how are we going to impact the culture? You know, how are we going to impact the culture? What are we going to do to change it? We need to change the way we're doing things. You know, church attendance is plummeting. Membership is plummeting. And, you know, there are a lot of really good ideas and a lot of really interesting ideas. A lot of them were too much in sort of the political direction, but a lot of good ideas. And then this pastor got up and he hadn't spoken yet. And there's this great virtue in like being not speaking for a whole weekend so that when you do get up, then everybody wants to know what you're going to say. I can't do that. I'm so sorry. But anyway, he gets up. He's the last one to speak. And he says this, quite simply, have we tried the fruits of the Spirit? And there was just kind of this silence that settled over the room. And it was like, no, don't think we've done that yet. I don't think we've done that yet. And that's what I would say to us in this room of very powerful people with enormous amount of influence, who often look at a future that looks uncertain, with animosity that is spreading everywhere, with hatred that is rising, with division that is escalating. And we're going to have to ask ourselves, what are we going to do about this? And I think the answer that we have to ask ourselves is, have we tried the fruits of the Spirit? Thank you all so much.